Welcome to the Foresight Health Roundup Podcast, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Thursday, August 14th. We're still not talking about the Epstein files on today's show, but we are talking about sharing files. More specifically, the electronic files containing your protected health information, thanks to the Health Tech Ecosystem Initiative announced by HHS on July 30th. To tell us why we should care about this new initiative are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How you two doing this morning? Dave?
Well, with apologies to the Hollies, when it gets to this time of year, all I need is the air that I breathe and corn on the cob. Of course, the tomatoes, blueberries, other fruits and vegetables just add to my culinary delight. Let's all go to the farmer's markets.
Yeah, if it is a good time of year. Julie, how are you?
Yeah, we are taking in all we can of summer before school starts, that's for sure. So doing well, thanks.
Yeah, I think our school district starts oddly tomorrow.
Wow.
Right. And then the kids get a weekend break. Like one day was must be shocking. So they have to have 2 days off and hit it hard on Monday. So whatever, you know,
Prozac on the weekends.
Yeah, I guess. All right. Before we discuss HHS's health tech ecosystem plan, let's talk about Social Security. Dave and I know a little about, I think. 90 years ago today, FDR signed the Social Security Act of 1935 as part of his New Deal program, giving Americans a basic set of financial benefits when they retire. And that's when the federal government actually tried to help people in need. So, Dave, first of all, are you collecting Social Security yet? And second, do you think Social Security will live for another 90 years?
Yes, I just started. I wasn't planning to collect my Social Security until I turned 70, but then the Trump administration came into power and decided to accelerate the process. I got to say, it almost feels like magic after all these decades of paying Social Security taxes. A check now arrives in our bank account every fourth Wednesday of the month. But to your other point, and this will probably be a little contrarian, my belief is that the productivity boost that the national economy will receive from artificial intelligence, AI, will generate enough wealth not only to continue funding Social Security, but to give every American a guaranteed annual income, just like John Maynard Keynes foretold almost 100 years ago.
Wow, that's very optimistic, Dave. I'm going to count on that.
If we don't blow ourselves up first, that's the question.
Right, there you go. All right, back to reality. Julie, I'm not even going to ask you the first question because I know the answer, but I will ask you how long you think Social Security is going to last.
Well, I definitely would like to drink some of Dave's Kool-Aid. Gosh, you know what? This has been the age-old issue that doesn't go away. And never seems to blow up, but we all know is so fragile. So I'd like to think it's going to limp along for decades to come like it has, but I don't know. It seems like we're teetering a little bit here on many things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm not in it yet. I plan on taking mine at age 70, so I hope it's around for at least another 5 years. And I do think it's going to be around for another 90. You know, millions of Americans depend on Social Security to live, and it's their money. They pay their FICA taxes, as we all do. And can we be so cruel as to let millions of elderly Americans fend for themselves, hoping that they were diligent enough and made enough money to put away for retirement, right? That's a lot of false hope, and there's your transition into today's topic on the Roundup, HHS's new health tech ecosystem initiative. Let me share a few bullet points from the initiative, tell you who literally signed a pledge on camera at a Make Health Tech Great Again event to support the initiative, then ask you for your best case, worst case scenario. Under the initiative, healthcare organizations can become part of a, quote, CMS-aligned network, close quote. Organizations can become part of the CMS-aligned network by voluntarily following the criteria in CMS's interoperability framework. Those criteria fall into five buckets: patient access and empowerment, provider access and delegation, data availability and standards compliance, network connectivity and transparency, and identity security and trust. Basically, organizations promise to make their systems interoperable with others in the network and make protected health information available to patients from any access point in the network. The following EHR vendors signed the Health Tech Ecosystem Pledge, promising to let their customers participate in the network: Athena Health, Epic, Oracle Health, and eClinical Works. Some of the data networks that took the pledge include Be Well Connected Health, Commonwealth Health Alliance, eHealth Exchange, and Surescripts. Some of the health systems that took the pledge include the Cleveland Clinic, CVS Health, Intermountain Health, and Providence. And some of the health insurers that took the pledge include Aetna, Humana, United Health, and Elevance Health. Oh, and I forgot to mention two other small players, Amazon and CMS itself. Dave, what's your first reaction to the initiative? Are you surprised, not surprised at who signed the pledge on camera? And what's your best case, worst case scenario for the plan?
A couple of points before I discuss the best and worst case scenarios. I was actually delighted to see plan, and everybody's kissing the ring these days, so I guess I'm not surprised at the full-on embrace at the press conference. But a couple things. First, health data interoperability has been improving. It's much easier for patients, sometimes called consumers, to access and understand their health data than it was 5 years ago, and it's light years better than it was 10 years ago. Having said that, there's still too much data fragmentation and process friction, but let's not deny the systematic evolution toward health data interoperability. It is occurring. Second, there is an inherent dilemma between health data interoperability and health data privacy. More of the former does increase the risk of personal health data ending up in the wrong hands and/or being used for illicit purposes. Important questions relate to how much and to what extent these events can occur. My initial read of, quote, make America health tech great again. By the way, healthcare tech in America has never been great. But anyway, make American health tech great again, is that the program's designers and participants are acutely aware of the privacy issues and are attempting to build safeguards into the platform. We can't run away from this problem, but we also can't live in caves. The industry needs to do the work to improve interoperability and minimize the loss of data privacy. Okay, best case scenario. This is a voluntary program, but the volunteers, as you enumerated, Dave, including CMS, represent the majority of the provider, tech, and payer marketplace. If they can agree on standards and work constructively to implement them, all other parts of the ecosystem will have to fall in line. I particularly like the prohibition of requiring individual portals for consumers to access their data. The program's goal is to have data flow to the patient or consumer's portals of choice. You know, we're all acutely aware of what happens when you have too many competing portals to get information. Progress stops. So I really like that feature of the program. And finally, the Trump administration has not been shy about using its leverage to get what they want. Just ask Harvard. Data operability is a noble and achievable goal. If the Trump administration demands adherence, chances are the industry will comply. Best case scenario. Worst case scenario, we've all been here before. Big vision, big promises, presidential leadership. But then after the press conferences, the industry incumbents revert to behaviors that reward them at the expense of greater American society. Several questions. Will Epic really give up its walled garden approach to data sharing and its socialist design for MyChart and its insistence that providers have to be inside its tent using its tools, paying its fees to achieve better data interoperability? Another question, will big tech honor its pledge not to misuse patient health data when their entire business models seek to exploit and monetize consumer data? Another good question. Will the Trump administration maintain focus and pressure on the industry to deliver on its promises of health data interoperability? And then finally, will payers and providers collectively work for the common good, better health outcomes at lower costs with great customer experience? Hasn't been the case up to this point. So these are big questions. The worst case scenario is what I call MAFA, M-A-F-A, mistaking articulation for accomplishment. Instead of racing toward health data interoperability, we will continue as an industry to trudge reluctantly forward.
Thanks, Dave. Julie, any questions for Dave?
Well, I think my question might be in parts of your questions, but, you know, my question here is CMS really going to be able to, like, ensure not only these technical compliance mandates, but or vision or whatever it is, but also the kind of practical access to usable real-time data for patients, especially given what you articulated with, you know, potential EHR company resistance?
Yeah, I believe the answer is yes. CMS under Trump, as I discussed, has the wherewithal and the damn the torpedoes attitude to make this happen, should they so choose. You know, several years ago, probably 20 years ago, I was part of a task force convened by CMS to tackle the problem of children's hospitals, performance data funding. Broadly, and a whole host of industry participants came to the meeting and engaged in the dialogue. And I was just struck by how chicken shit CMS was. They were looking for feedback. They were trying to build consensus. They weren't trying to drive an agenda at all. And of course, the whole thing failed miserably. So it's possible that, and maybe even probable, that the Trump administration, given the way they approach governance, will make this happen. I think it's also important to remember that during Trump 1, CMS delivered significant progress against fierce industry opposition on data interoperability and pricing transparency. In this sense, Trump 2 is building on a proven track record in pushing this Make America Health Tech Great Again policy agenda. But I think your question really gets to a difference between words, will and can. You asked, will they? They certainly have the ability, so they can. But will they? On that question, the jury is still out, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think that is the first time we've ever used the word chicken shit on this podcast. That is a great word, and I hope we hear it more often because that really worked. Yeah. Thanks, Dave. Okay, Julie, it's your turn. When you saw this, what was your first reaction? How do you think it will change the health tech market, given the heavy hand from the federal government? And what's your best case, a worst case scenario next year when this thing starts happening?
Well, I have to say, when I saw this, I wasn't surprised in a sense that it's very consistent with Oz's messaging from the beginning. When I heard him at Health Evolution this year, he talked about the fact that we have a generational opportunity to transform healthcare through technology. And he talked about, you know, the role of private investment and argued that, you know, funding is crucial for making sure that these innovators, you know, can challenge the entrenched incumbents and that good ideas need capital. And this kind of, you know, this marketplace approach is a lot of that kind of thinking. And, you know, he talked a lot about creating a really transparent CMS and fostering a more predictable, fundable, investable healthcare industry. And I think a lot of what you could see happening with almost the democratization of, you know, solutions that could be part of this, I see so many threads of what he's been saying. So I guess, first of all, I wasn't totally surprised. Second, the CMS team is now led by a number of former digital health entrepreneurs who understand information needs for care delivery and value-based care. They've been in this business. They've hit their heads against the wall. You know, they know the importance of empowering the patient, and they understand how to use at least some levers to drive innovation and change. So this honestly might be a first in our federal government, and it definitely shows in this framework. Three, AI companies are quite prominent in this announcement, which feels really different than previous announcements with big tech companies. You know, you see the usual suspects typically, but this is definitely a slightly different set of players, which, you know, also feels like a first. Four, I will admit, I rolled my eyes. Well, you know, a lot of the underlying work with FHIR and health information exchanges and TEFCA, and frankly, a laundry list of standards and other, you know, data sharing advancements are already underway. There's been a lot of work going on in, you know, the last 4, 8, 20 years. The headline promises here do feel like they're way beyond the simplicity of the words. Like, some of the patient access use cases and other statements made here are definitely realistic, but the more complex data needs for public health and research, you know, they require more infrastructure, and data is just dirty. Identity is challenging. And as you've seen in all the coverage, the privacy advocates are kind of, you know, out and loud. So at the end of the day, I think I've been in this health information exchange side of the world for too long to think that technology is really going to solve this, because these incumbent business models, I don't know, they still reign over the technical capabilities. Now, that said, a lot of people I respect on both sides of the aisle, frankly, have been spending days, honestly, for the last couple of weeks in DC trying to figure out how to leverage, you know, all that's been built. And my understanding from, you know, those in the know is that the health information exchanges, especially the few around the country that have become, you know, pretty impressive data utilities, they're being looked at as potentially, you know, a significant component of the national health data infrastructure. And I grew up on this side. I'm a health HIE devotee. This is important because these organizations might be some of the only orgs that are capable of enabling kind of a proactive data exchange for the use cases in public health and quality measurement and, you know, pharmacology surveillance. And, you know, a lot of these have figured out how to also work within the constructs of their state and thing. Again, the privacy advocates, the state's privacy laws and policies. And by the way, that's something that TEFCA doesn't do. So I'm just, that excites me, to be honest with you. And I hope there's something there, really. And then just finally, I'll say, stepping back, if I just remove the Trump from the scenario, I could get really excited. Like, this could democratize solutions in a really positive way for smaller, more innovative companies. And it could push us beyond the interoperability basics to really forcing all these solutions to compete on their value and their quality and, you know, their efficiency and savings and giving choice and control to consumers. So we could really start delivering on things that we need to do instead of the basics. But I will say, I read the Matt Holt article, and, you know, like Matthew, I worry. I wish I didn't, but I do.
Yeah.
That was something.
Yeah.
That was something.
And your comment about people with expertise and experience being involved behind the scenes, being a first for the federal government, did not escape me. Love the sarcasm. Thanks, Julie. Dave, any questions for Julie?
Well, for the listeners who aren't familiar with Matthew Holt, he basically asks the question of what do you do when a despicable administration proposes a good policy? How should you behave? And he takes great umbrage at the way the industry writ large was embracing Trump administration officials doing selfies and so on. Well worth reading, particularly if you agree with that point of view, which many of us do.
By the way, Dave, another woman we're fans of, the CEO of Be Well, you know, Kristen wrote that great LinkedIn post that shockingly she had a few haters for writing it. I thought that was interesting. But you know, it's nice to have someone like her who's so deep in this stuff.
And so credible too. So credible.
Totally. Yeah. You know, try to give everybody like the straight scoop of, you know, what this is really saying and what it's not. So I do think there's a lot of people weighing in with really thoughtful and helpful perspectives.
So my question, Julie, and it's somewhat obvious, but I'd love to hear your take on it. Would full interoperability between payers, providers, and suppliers be easier, more effective, and efficient if the system incorporated a standardized user identification code? And if that's true, which it probably is, why not acknowledge this reality, bite the bullet, and get it done?
You know, The first year I started working with the California Healthcare Foundation on HIE concepts was 1999. And it's 2025. This patient identity issue, the NPI, I mean, it's been going on much longer than I've been, you know, associated with HIE thinking. Obviously, the interoperability capabilities have come a long way. And a lot of people argue that we have technology workarounds today. The political resistance is too strong. Obviously, now that we have some really prominent technology vendors, folks like Epic and Cerner and Commonwealth, they have their own patient matching frameworks. So there is a lot that can be done today. But at the end of the day, I still think it matters. Like the matching accuracy is, it needs to be as good as it can be. I don't want to use the word perfect. And without an NPI, you just can't guarantee that, especially with cross-system interoperability. So I don't know if it's ever going to happen. I personally would love to see it happen, but it's just such a political football.
Yeah, it's a basic building block of all of this, and maybe we'll get there someday. Thanks, Julie. As much as I am for total interoperability, I'm not sure I want someone from this version of HHS or CMS sitting in a chair in my office with the door closed, which you know is going to happen. I just don't trust their intentions, given the past 8 months and what we've seen. There's an agenda there that we can speculate on, but we won't. But I'll just say, when you lay down with dogs, you get fleas, right?
Or selfies.
So, or selfies, yeah. I'm in the Matthew Holt camp. Now let's talk about other big healthcare news that happened this week. There's never a shortage of it. Julie, what topped your list of things we should know about?
Well, this isn't probably a secret for anybody, but the announcement by Epic that they launched their own AI scribe has definitely sent some ripple effects through digital health after their partnership with Abridge. So, you know, I'd love to be a fly on the wall at Epic's UGM this month and certainly in the Abridge boardroom.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting rollout. Dave, what's your big story of the week?
Well, I wanted to draw listeners' attention to the Keckley report, Paul Keckley's report from August 4th, where he described several things that happened in July 2025, and said as we go forward, July 2025 will be the month U.S. healthcare leaders recognize as the industry's modern turning point. And the four things he mentioned were the Big Beautiful Bill Act, the fact that the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported anemic growth and the consumer price index went up just 0.3%. And of course, the leader got fired for that announcement. And then you had Trump's directive to 17 drug companies ordering them to reduce prices on their drugs by September 29th or else. And then the jobs report also by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So you had those four things. And Paul collectively sees these actions reflecting absolute disdain for the healthcare industry by the GOP-led Congress. Here's his take. The landscape for U.S. healthcare has fundamentally changed as a result of the July actions noted above. It is compounded by public anxiety about the economy at home and global tensions abroad. And in making this conclusion, he also talks about how the healthcare industry just continues to raise prices at above inflation. So basically stealing resources from other parts of the economy. And I think he's putting all of this on a collision course. So directionally, I think he's right. And maybe he's even right about July 2025. So I'd encourage people to read his report from August 4th. And Dave, maybe we can include it as a link on this podcast.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. Thanks, Julie. And thank you, Dave. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can subscribe to the Roundup on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.